We now move to the 9th and 10th commandments. These commandments focus on intention. They recognize that corruption of intention leads to the actions that are condemned in the earlier commandments, especially the 6th and 7th commandment. And this 9th and 10th commandments reads, and you mightn't recall, but right back at the beginning of the 10 commandments, I alerted you to the fact that people divide the commandments differently. Their numbers are different. To have the 9th and 10th here, you really have to divide a sentence almost. It reads like this anyhow, the whole lot. You shall not covet your neighbour's wife. You shall not desire your neighbour's house, field, manservant, maidservant, ox, ass, or anything that belongs to your neighbour. So that's the 9th and 10th, and they have a different wording in Deuteronomy and Exodus and so on. So they're about desire. Here we read in the New Testament, Jesus, everyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Now, to look at a woman lustfully doesn't mean to be attracted sexually to the woman. That's probably a pretty healthy male thing. And on the other side, it would be a healthy female thing enough. Now, to look lustfully is to do with the way you see the person and the intentions that form in your mind towards making a decision in relation to her. So it's about, it's not just about, wow, you know. It's about, you know, wiggling your way in maybe to break the relationship or to whatever it might be that you're intending. So it's about intention and perception, but leading to intention and decision to act in certain ways. Jesus says, we're talking about the heart now. So Jesus says a beautiful thing, where your treasure is, that is where your heart is as well. And the most of this rest of the time I'll be talking about the scriptural perception of the heart. Concupiscence is a big word that we probably are vaguely familiar with. So this distortion of the heart is traditionally called concupiscence. And I'm giving you my words first, then I'll give you the words of a great theologian, Rana. We're like fish spawned into a river that's partly polluted. Hereditary and environmental factors have influenced us from the first moments of our consciousness. And even before. In various ways and to varying degrees, we find ourselves desiring what is not good for us. Our heart, our longings are not all pure. They're not all in accordance with the truth, with the way things really are. And this, as you can gather, is really at the heart of what we mean by original sin. The sins of our origins. The sins, as it were, that we inherit from our parents primarily, grandparents and all the throwbacks and all the rest of it, and the environmental pressures around us. So not what we've done sinful, but our origin into this river of humanity, sadly, the river is not totally pure. So we're not given the truth by everybody, and our parents are imperfect necessarily, so we pick up things from them too that aren't, and we hand on things that aren't so good to our children, even with the best will in the world. Well, that's concupiscence. These desires we have that are somehow twisted, not pure, not directed to the truth, but somehow wangled in some way. Here's Rana in a article in the Theological Investigations called Grace and Concupiscence. And he writes, in the course of its self-determination, The person undergoes the resistance of the nature given prior to freedom and never wholly succeeds in making all that man is, all that human beings are, into the reality and the expression of all that he comprehends himself to be in the core of his person. There's much in man which always remains in concrete fact, somehow impersonal, impenetrable, and unilluminated for his existential decision, merely endured and not freely acted out. It is this dualism between person and nature that we call concupiscence in the theological sense. That's a bit abstract. It's actually very good, I think, but it'll require you to think about it quite a bit at home to get it clear. The person is, you are a person and I am a person to the extent that we have embraced freedom and lived it well. But we've got our nature too, that is as yet impersonal a bit, not yet caught up in the freedom of our good decisions, but somehow feelings and so on. So it's that disjunction between what I've inherited and what I've seen as a little child and what I've noticed with my parents arguing, or what I've seen from an alcoholic uncle, or what's happened to me if I've been abused as a child. You can get through the whole thing, can't you? All the different levels of this, all this stuff that might happen to a person confuses and distorts the purity of a lovely longing that would be quite beautiful. And some of us have a whole lot of original sin we're born in. Some of us, if you had saints as parents, you've probably only got a little bit of it. It's not one thing, original sin. Some of us inherit a thick layer of, don't we, of difficulty and complexity and hurt and not being loved. And we might be in a culture that's violent and gathered all around drugs and prostitution and something. Or we might have been born into an idyllic, beautiful place with saintly parents. And so everyone's different. But we've all got this journey to make to find our individual person, to embrace freedom and all that, and learn to love and be loved to the purest way we can. And the conflict there is this concupiscence that keeps getting in the road. So let's, if you would, talk to you about the human heart. Is the centre of consciousness, intention and decision in the biblical sense. So there's a close correspondence between heart and spirit in the Bible. Spirit always means your communion with God. Here's a lovely psalm which you know. Create in me a clean heart, O God. Put a new and right spirit within me. So you're praying for a clean inner being that is the source of your consciousness, intentions and decisions. And you know the only way to get that is to have this beautiful communion with God, which is pured, the spirit, that your spirit is pure. The heart, again, I'm taking you through a biblical look at heart. The heart belongs to God who made it and knows it. Here's some texts. Yahweh molds every heart. It's a beautiful image of God as a potter forming the heart of the little child, of you as a little child and you as a teenager and you now. Human beings look to appearances, says the book of Samuel. Yahweh sees the heart. The third point on the biblical understanding of heart. We must go to the heart and we must follow it. This is profoundly sound advice. some of us might have been brought up, and it's fairly normal to distrust the heart and therefore to do what other people tell us and to learn what to do from others and never to find ourselves really, and to be obedient and submissive and fit into the pattern. And do you get me? So that's all can be fairly heavy in some families and some cultures, others less. But you have to actually trust your heart. Now, you have to trust it and learn to that it's not perfect too. So the aim of life, surely, and education, is to find the heart and purify it with prayer. If I don't find it, I'll never purify it. I might do what I'm told morally by everybody else, but I'll never learn to fly. I'll be like a caged bird for the rest of my life because I'll never actually fly. I don't know who I am, and that's not unnormal either. So we need a people, a community, a family, a religion that liberates us from the cage and teaches us to fly. And it's hard to teach someone to fly. You parents know this better than I do. You teach your kids to fly and that's what they do. And the nest's empty. And it'd be nicer to have them at home all the time, wouldn't it, I think? No. No. Oh, well, that's the other. I must have lived in that ideal home. I never... Now that I think of it, I left home at 12. I wonder whose idea that was. So, here we are. But this is really very deep and very important. And I'm quoting to you from the book of Sirach and the book of Proverbs. Heed the counsel of your own heart. No one is more faithful to you than is your heart. Your soul often forewarns you. It's better than seven watchmen perched on a watchtower. But then he adds very wisely, you must beg the Most High to guide your steps in the truth. It's subtle, isn't it? But lovely. So, listen to your heart, but pray that you'll be guided to make wise, beautiful, pure, truthful decisions. But you don't do it by blocking off your heart and doing what you're told without reference to the heart. Proverbs reads, more than all else, keep watch over your heart. There are the wellsprings of life. Psalm 20, verse 40 reads, may Yahweh grant you your heart's desire. To the best of my knowledge, the first encyclical of Pope Benedict XVI on love is the first statement from the Vatican that talks about erotic love and how important it is. If you haven't read it, please read it. It's a very simple... It was half prepared by John Paul II before he died, but the Pope picked it up and made it his own and presented it. The erotic love, the eros, you know, that longing, desire that shows itself most powerfully in sexual love, but in many other ways too. This longing, it's very sacred stuff. It's our energy, it's our vital energy, and it can be directed beautifully or it can be directed badly, and we have to learn how to direct it beautifully. But we have to direct it, not repress it, you know? Not swamp it. And some of us, I think, were probably taught in older days to swamp it. And some of our kids aren't swamping it, and we're worried about them because they're going off in all kinds of directions. So it's a complex matter, but I think what that is telling me, anyhow, and you, is take the heart really seriously and listen to your deepest desires, because your deepest desires are actually very beautiful. And we have to learn to listen to them and get down underneath the complexities and the rest of it. The heart on its own can be unwise. This is not news to you, but I'm just reading you from the Bible, from Proverbs, Jeremiah, Matthew, Jesus' words. Listen to this. First of all, Proverbs. The person who trusts his own heart is a fool. The one whose ways are wise will be safe. So this is like a counterpoint to what I've just said, eh? Listen to it, but you can be a fool if you just trust it entirely. Don't listen to what the prophets are saying. They're deluding you, says Jeremiah. They're retailing visions from your own hearts and not what comes from the mouth of Yahweh. So be confused, you're meant to be. There's a truth there and a truth there and a half-truth there and a half-truth there, and they both have to be held together. Otherwise we think whatever we want is good, forgetting concupiscence. Jesus says, out of the heart come evil intentions, murder, adultery, fornication, theft, false slander, false witness, slander. He runs through the Ten Commandments. This is where they come from, finally. The unpurified heart. The top layers of the heart that haven't gone right down to the deepest longings. Some more biblical material on the heart about insincerity of heart and hypocrisy. Here's Proverbs 26. Good image, I reckon. A glaze applied to an earthen pot. Such are the smooth lips and the wicked heart. It's a beautiful ceramic, painted over the ceramic, but it's only clay inside. Psalm 78, though they outwardly flattered him and used their tongues to lie to him, in their hearts they were not true to him. They were unfaithful to his covenant. A hardened heart has to be broken. Contritus in Latin means smashed. Contritus. So contrite heart. The hardened heart has to be broken. An adulterated heart, a heart that's got mixtures in it, has to be purified. Like a river has to cleanse itself. We pray, create in me a clean heart, O God. And the same psalm, you will not scorn this crushed, contrite, and broken heart. The Bible, both old and new, tell us to set our heart on God. If you start searching once more for Yahweh your God, if you seek Yahweh with all your heart, you will find. And Jesus, blessed are the pure in heart, they will see God. Another aspect of the biblical teaching on heart, God is close to the heart that looks to him. Psalm 34, Yahweh is near to the brokenhearted. Isaiah 61, Yahweh sent me to bind up hearts that are broken. I think it seems to me a universal human experience. In any case, it's mine. I go along for the most part fairly easily because I've got an easy temperament. I don't go up and I don't go down. I'm just kind of boringly medium. You know, so just, you know, life goes on. I don't like it, but when something really hard happens to me and I get really hurt, I'm a much better person. You know what I mean? You kind of go deeper, or you're forced to go deeper. I find myself praying better, I find myself being better and all that. But I don't want to have that feeling, so I'm not asking for it. And I think that's almost normal. People, we get the crushed heart realizes that you need something, so you reach out for it. At least I tend to. God has sent the Spirit of his Son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. Now, some quotes from the Catechism. Number 2520. Excuse me. Purity of intention consists in seeking to find and fulfill God's will in everything. It's a beautiful prayer to pray. to want to know God's will, to really want it, and then to be open to listen and see it. Purity of intention is when you're seeking. It's all we can do. 12521 talks about modesty. Protects a person's intimate centre. It's ordered to chastity. These are beautiful virtues, of course. Modesty, chastity. It guides how one looks at others and behaves towards them, sensitive to a person's dignity. So, all you beautiful grandparents, whatever you do, train your grandchildren in modesty. It's such a protection, isn't it? And it's not a modern virtue. Like the culture doesn't particularly admire it. And if we train them in modesty and chastity, which is pure loving, loving that's pure and beautiful, so we're giving them our greatest gift. 2525 of the Catechism reads, Christian purity requires a purification of the social climate. It requires of the communications media that their presentation show concern for respect and restraint. Purity of heart brings freedom from widespread eroticism and avoids entertainment inclined to voyeurism and illusion. Big words for something we all know. The Catechism talks about avarice, greed, and envy. And I want to conclude with a lovely topic, which is the topic relevant to this, of what's called in the spiritual writings, detachment. Excuse me. This is written by a Carthusian, and generally when they write, they don't give their name. They're a monk, and they're not into putting their personality forward. And it's a beautiful book called The Way of Silent Love. And see if you are helped by what he says here. There is no peace without detachment. There's no detachment without effective renunciation. There it is, he says, the hard saying. Our passions carry us towards what is pleasing and delightful, towards what we love. Thus they cause us to avoid what is unpleasant and hurtful, the things we fear and hate. The way of resurrection is the way of death, a curtailment of life, a mortification, big word for putting to death, of the senses, etc. Today, as always, we don't want it. But listen to Christ. If you would follow me, deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow me. Then very wisely he goes on to say this. In speaking of detachment, I'm afraid of giving too much importance to what is of little consequence. Certainly, detachment from things is an essential element of the spiritual life. It doesn't mean we are obligated to make a continual effort of the will to be detached. A continual preoccupation such as this is unhealthy, and sometimes results in a negative attitude and bitterness that has little to do with Christian simplicity and joy. And in the end, it puts too much emphasis on secondary matters. To be continually preoccupied with denying ourselves something is to feed the desire to possess and to give it importance. And he concludes, the true contemplative doesn't need to to make a constant effort to mortify the senses. Only love is necessary. The heart turned towards God and the things of God. The true contemplative realizes that things are leaving him and detaching themselves from him. Age alone brings that. He quickly forgets them, so fascinated is he with the discovery of the wondrous majesty. Let us not be like the fearful people who on the mountain didn't take their eyes from their feet for fear of stumbling and were thus unable to revel in the broad horizon and the vast expanses. Let us be bold enough to be joyful. Christ and the love of God are worth it.
When you get old, you don't take your eyes from down there to feel it coming. And that's true.
I know.
And it's sad because you cannot look around you. I don't even speak to people anymore because I don't see them. I'm so busy looking where I'm going.
So every 5 yards, what about stopping? Standing still, looking around, greeting people, listening to the birds sing, and resting, and then take another 5 steps and then stop.
My husband's dragging me along.
I knew there'd be a bloke behind it. Thank you. The science of detachment is a science of love. Only God has the wisdom to know what it is that we need to let go and when we're ready to do so. That's my little addition in there, and I think it's right. We shouldn't be concentrating on what should I let go. We should be concentrating on love and when something is taken from us, we let it go. In other words, Teresa of Lisieux puts it very beautifully. She says, I want to die with open hands. So you hold what's given to you, but you don't clench your fists and struggle to keep it. You simply let it come and let it go. I suppose that must be it. And do it in the name of love. John of the Cross writes, see if you like this, in self-dispossession, the heart is at rest. It wants nothing because it's grounded on Jesus, not on itself. It doesn't matter whether it feels elated or dejected. How you get to that point, I have the foggiest idea, but some of you are probably there, tell me. But to come to that kind of detachment where you take life as it is, when you see people who do it, it's very beautiful. And Teresa of Avila, you probably know this famous poem. Let nothing disturb you. Let nothing dismay you. All things pass. God never changes. Patience attains all. The one who has God lacks nothing. God alone suffices. And now for a bit of French prose. Tired de Chardin. French prose and French, that's why I loved French. I taught it for years and I found it a remarkable language because unlike English, as I understand English, we either have poetry or prose, and it's good, I like it, it's clear, you know what you're saying. French, even their prose is poetic, a bit like Irish. It seems to me like that. So when you listen to Tired de Chardin, you're listening to prose, but you're in the flights of something. So see how you go with this. I've got 2 statements from him that I like, and I reckon they're wise and lovely. He says this, Everything is needed. Because the world will never be large enough to provide our taste for action with the means of grasping God, or our thirst for receiving with the possibility of being invaded by God. Yet, nothing is needed. For as the only reality which can satisfy us lies beyond the transparencies in which it is mirrored, everything that fades away and dies between us will serve only to give reality back to us with greater purity. You just have to keep reading that till you love it, because I think it's quite stunning and very beautifully balanced. And so Teilhard, this is in his beautiful book, if you haven't read The Divine Milieu by Teilhard de Chardin, you must read it. It's a must read. It's a simple book, it's beautiful, it's just wonderful spirituality and very modern and all that. And here's what he also says in the same book. Raise me up then, no matter, to those heights, through struggle and separation and death. Raise me up until at long last it becomes possible for me, in perfect chastity, to embrace the universe. Now the earth can certainly clasp me in her giant arms. She can swell me with her life or take me back into the dust. She can deck herself out for me with every charm, with every horror, with every mystery. She can intoxicate me with her perfume, her touch. She can cast me to my knees in expectation of what is maturing in her breast. But her enchantments can no longer do harm to me, since she has become for me the body of him who is and of him who is to come. Teilhard was archaeologist, paleontologist, he was many months a Jesuit priest out in the Gobi Desert in Mongolia, I think, out of Mongolia somewhere. And he's got this other beautiful book written, Mass Over the World, I think he might call it. And for him, he didn't have any bread or wine. The sun rising above the desert was the host that he offered to God, as a Eucharist. Like, he had this lovely sense of loving the world. And being detached doesn't mean not loving, and it doesn't mean holding on to. It means not wanting it for yourself when love requires you or it to move on. It's holding gently. And he was a wonderful fellow, I think, anyhow. In my seminary days, 50 years ago, no one inspired me more than Teilhard de Chardin, so thank God for his writing, it helped me go. Now I've finished with the last. This is a contemporary Carmelite English religious sister. All her books are worth reading. Ruth Burroughs. You won't ever not be challenged. She writes every sentence is like a punch. It's direct, very clear, you can't avoid it, and you're caught by it, but it's enlightening, and that's how I find her anyhow. She must have written 7 or 8 books. This is a book called To Believe in Jesus, and she has this to say, and I'll leave you with it. For the Christian to maintain a hunger for God, a God who does not satisfy our senses, we must take care not to so encompass ourselves with the good things of this world that our need for God is not experienced. If our desire for God is genuine, and we must not confuse real desire for feeling or emotion, then we will want to express it in concrete forms. Outward expressions strengthen the inner disposition. Hunger for God has to be worked for. It is a sustained act of choosing under the influence of grace. We cannot seek God always and serve our neighbour with a disinterested love until we've looked at ourselves and then positively denied this self-seeking and worked against it. So that's pretty complex, I suppose. I don't know. It's about the heart and it's about detachment and love. But those last two commandments, or the last three really, are edging towards Jesus. They're in the Ten Commandments. They're taking us into the subtleties of human desire, longing, attachment, purification, all of that. And then, of course, they come right through to Jesus, who is all about the heart, knowing that if our heart is pure, our actions will follow. That won't be a problem. So purifying the heart, because he loved the heart and trusted the heart and knew that it was made by God, and he wanted Mary of Magdala. He didn't want Mary of Magdala to stop living the life she was living. He wanted Mary of Magdala to become a saint. It's quite different, isn't it? That all her energy would go into loving. And he wanted the same for Peter and James and John, you and me. And that's why he was into freedom, and he wasn't into control, and he was into tears and prayer and embracing lepers, and because he wants all of us to find that lovely thing called the heart, to live from it, and that, because that is our connection with God. Okay, well, thank you very much. That's that.